Thank you for joining us, everyone. My name is Dr. William Finn. I'm currently the president of the American Society for Clinical Pathology. I'm also the medical director of Ward Medical Laboratory in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and a partner at the IHA Pathology and Laboratory Management Practice, also in Ann Arbor, Michigan. ASCP is committed to helping laboratory professionals and pathologists prepare themselves and their laboratories for a patient infected with Ebola virus. I have two distinguished guests here with me today. Dr. Nancy Cornish is a medical officer with the Division of Laboratory Programs, Standards, and Services, Center for Surveillance, Epidemiology, and Laboratory Services, and Office of Public Health Services, all with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Also joining me is Dr. Lance Peterson. He's the Director of Microbiology and Infectious Disease Research, the Vice Chair of Pathology 4 Research, and a senior attending with the Departments of Pathology, Laboratory Medicine, and Internal Medicine, all within the North Shore University Health System in Chicago, Illinois. He is also a clinical professor with the University of Chicago Pritzker School of Medicine. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both for taking the time to speak with our listeners about this very important topic. Let's start with some basic logistics around testing patients for the actual Ebola virus. After all, we can't treat an Ebola patient if we don't know we have one. Laboratory professionals have been submitting several questions on this topic to us. First, what are the basic logistics? What kind of paperwork, for instance, do we need for the initial specimen? And what information needs to be on the shipment sent to the CDC, Dr. Cornish?
Yeah, this is something that I believe laboratories and hospitals should develop plans well ahead of receiving a Ebola patient or a patient who may be under investigation for Ebola. So the first thing that they ought to do in the laboratory is call their public health lab and work with them to work out the procedure for what they would do if they get a patient under investigation and they need to send specimens to the CDC. They should also call the Emergency Operations Center at the CDC, and the phone number for that is 1-770-488-7100. The CDC is there available at that number 24/7 to assist laboratories and hospitals with the resulting specimen testing and questions that will inevitably arise. That will also include what kind of paperwork to fill out and how to send the specimen and what address to use.
Is this also available on your website?
Yes, it is. Yeah, and there is a special section on the website for laboratories. So if you go to the website and go to healthcare workers, under healthcare workers, you'll find laboratories, and the instructions are also there.
So what method of testing is actually done in order to determine if a patient has Ebola?
If the patient is accepted as a patient who is under investigation, then the testing that is done is an RT-PCR assay. And those are performed at both a Laboratory Response Network laboratory or at the CDC. So we have at least 18 LRN laboratories, which are public health laboratories, who are now performing this test in their laboratories. You will need to call your state public health lab to find out if they're one of the ones who are performing the test, or if they would recommend that you send it to either another state health laboratory, if that's closer, or directly to the CDC.
Is there any contact that has to be made to CDC and state health labs even before all this gets underway? In other words, if you're thinking of even drawing a patient for Ebola testing,
the minute that a patient is suspected or meets the criteria for possibly having Ebola, Ebola's in the differential diagnosis, then the call should be immediate to your state health department, state health lab, and the CDC.
So you mentioned where the testing takes place and the method by which the testing is done. What do you know about these sort of rapid PCR platforms? The film array instrument has been getting some press. What do you know about that?
Yes, that is also an RT-PCR system. It's for in vitro qualitative detection of Ebola Zaire virus, which has been detected in West Africa in 2014 in whole blood specimens from individuals with signs and symptoms of Ebola virus infection in conjunction with the epidemiologic risk factors. So it's not been FDA cleared or approved, but it has been authorized under an emergency use authorization for use by CLIA, moderate and high complexity laboratories for the presumptive detection of Ebola Zaire virus and not for any other viruses or pathogens. CDC at this point does not have any data on the sensitivity and specificity, and we are currently evaluating the system.
So you would still recommend contact to CDC and state health departments as soon as possible?
Absolutely.
So one question that we've discussed in fair length, and you could both comment on this one, is there going to be a point at which laboratories and professional societies across the U.S. could work with CDC to get tests like Ebola and other emerging pathogens like enterovirus D68, for instance, get these nucleic acid tests released to competent community labs, essentially as laboratory-developed tests outside of just the public health network?
I can speak to that. CDC is currently working with FDA and laboratories to evaluate new diagnostic assays. And if laboratories or professional societies wish to work with CDC, they can contact the Emergency Operations Center at the phone number that I mentioned and ask for the laboratory task force.
Dr. Peterson, do you have an angle on that?
Sure. In our discussions, generally the CDC has most of the laboratory specimen data to be able to do verification of assays. So being able to work jointly with hospital laboratories that might be interested in either using some of the CDC-developed assays, I think that would be of great interest to many professional societies and hospitals. And I realize there's an issue with the FDA's engagement in all of this as well, but there probably needs to be some discussion between CDC, larger hospital laboratories, and professional societies such as ASCP and the Association of Molecular Pathology as a group to figure out how to develop and deploy these assays that are reliable in a rapid way, you know, out to hospitals, because I think they'd be very helpful in managing some of these patients that might show up. If I could just comment a little bit on the laboratory notification as well.
Sure.
We found it very helpful to have a comprehensive hospital plan so that the laboratory knows right away when a patient has arrived that's at high risk for Ebola virus disease rather than when the specimen just arrives. So basically, how we set up our program is that we have an Ebola pager that goes off on three named individuals, and they immediately get involved with the contact point for the patient and help determine whether or not the patient is at high risk or whatever the risk level is for Ebola virus disease. One of their initial responsibilities that has to be accomplished within the first 30 minutes is to contact the laboratory to let them know that specimens are coming, so there's a single contact number within the laboratory, and then the laboratory has developed a contact tree to notify the laboratories that will be working on specimens as well as the personnel that will be taking care of processing the specimens. We will have a relatively small cohort of personnel, so if this occurs in the middle of the night, they would be coming in to do the testing. This ends up being relatively complex in the laboratory and coordinating with the entire hospital and healthcare organization that you're working for is very helpful.
So this would then be under the purview of system-wide safety policies and things like that?
So generally, infection control
not just isolated to the laboratory, in other words.
That's correct. So infection control has taken the lead. But these patients do take a lot of hospital resources in this. Probably unlikely that most healthcare facilities in the United States could handle more than two at one time, so you need a fair amount of coordination to effectively deal with this. And as Dr. Cornish says, one of the early things you need to do is to contact your State Department Health Laboratory so you can start the process going in order to get the testing done, because the longer it takes to get the test results back, the more uncertainty you have as to what you're going to be doing with these patients.
Okay. So let's say now we've followed all of directives. We've contacted our state health department. We've contacted CDC. Specimens have been sent appropriately, and results come back positive. So once we know we have a patient with Ebola, a larger system would have chimed in by that. There'll be isolation rules and so on. But what happens then in terms of laboratory testing? I mean, what basic types of tests should be performed on a suspected Ebola patient, Dr. Peterson?
Well, I think this is a great question, and this is another area where first I feel that the laboratory needs to determine what tests they can safely do, and what that means is what tests can be done by people that are protected by personal protective equipment, as well as using instruments. Generally, point-of-care instrumentation is going to be used that doesn't generate aerosols. And once those tests are determined of what can be safely done, then a discussion needs to take place with healthcare providers, generally the intensivists and the emergency department physicians, as to what is appropriate to do. So, for instance, we've decided not to do urinalysis because we don't really feel that there's anything that we would gain from doing a urinalysis on a patient that is coming in with Ebola virus disease. And so if there's no potential benefit from a particular test, even though it could be done, there's probably no point in doing it. But we will do anything that is appropriate for the patient as long as we can do it safely. And this is again emerging, so people will be able to do more and more as we understand more about the disease. The laboratories have generally decided to either set up the point-of-care testing near the patient's room where they'll be housed, or in a biological safety cabinet in a closed, contained room within the laboratory. We've actually selected the second because we can actually believe we can handle the specimens more safely in that manner.
Dr. Corners, do you have an angle on that?
I think clinical care for patients with Ebola will be determined by the attending physician and clinical care team. And point-of-care testing is certainly an alternative option for facilities and is discussed to a limited extent in our guidance. But it is not the focus of CDC guidance for managing specimens from patients who have Ebola virus. And not all laboratory tests can be performed on point-of-care instruments. So therefore, it's really important to develop a plan and procedures to deal with tests that you may be asked to perform, and to start that by doing a risk assessment of the instrumentation you have in place and what your workflow will be and where you will work the specimens up. It will not be the same for every laboratory. Every laboratory has different issues, different instrumentation, different workflows, so they're going to need to determine what is best for them.
Are there biosafety level certification requirements, or can any qualified lab undertake this kind of a plan?
I think the risk assessment will educate the laboratory and whether they can handle specimens safely or not, following what the guidance is for how to handle specimens that may or do contain Ebola.
So you mentioned the choice between point-of-care testing versus testing in closed analyzers being sort of case-by-case depending on the preparedness plan for an individual center. But there are certain tests that just cannot be done by point-of-care, such as blood bank and microbiology testing. Are there any recommendations for tests for which point-of-care simply isn't an option?
Right. So that's where you need to sit down and make sure that you are protected from the specimen. So, for example, doing microbiology, if you're working with blood, for instance, and making a malaria smear as an example, you will want to open that specimen or decap it appropriately. You'll want to be wearing your PPE, which would consist of a closed front gown, double gloves, mask, full facial protection, and be working in a hood. a biosafety cabinet. And thinking about where that blood could splatter if there's some splattering, and then following all your procedures for taking off your PPE after you've made the specimen and disposing of everything appropriately. So that's not something that you can do right off the cuff without thinking about it. That's where you really need to develop a plan and procedures to handle that. And what I want to stress is that every specimen we work with has the potential to contain pathogens. So not only HIV and hepatitis B and C, meningococcus, you know, tularensis, all kinds of pathogens can be in that specimen. So we really need to handle all of our specimens following the OSHA bloodborne pathogens and standard precaution guidelines, not just blood specimens, but also body fluids. So I feel very strongly that our policies and procedures should be in place now to protect us from every bloodborne or body fluid pathogen.
So is Ebola virus beyond standard precautions or universal precautions?
No.
Well, it is. Ebola virus is a level 4 pathogen if you're growing it.
Right. So at the CDC, when we grow the virus or culture the virus, we often grow it to very high titers for vaccination studies, for example. And in that case, you would be working under level 4 conditions. The same is true for HIV. If you are growing HIV in culture, you're working with it under level 4 conditions. However, Ebola from clinical samples from patients can be handled under biosafety level 2 with biosafety level 3 extra precautions.
So continuing on the issue of safety and specimen handling, how do we deal with things like specimen spills, for instance? Dr. Peterson, you were mentioning you had plans in place at your facilities. What sort of contingency do you have for a sample spill? A tube hits the floor and breaks open, that kind of thing.
Right. So that's the first thing is to do is to try to avoid having an opportunity for a tube to drop. Basically, the specimens are to be carried double bagged in closed containers, closed rigid containers, transporting from the patient's side by hand with somebody carrying them to the laboratory and then placed in a biological safety cabinet. Spills are well described in the environmental standards for decontamination and require an OSHA-certified disinfectant that is active against non-envelope viruses. This is an envelope virus, but the recommendations are to use the higher disinfecting material for non-envelope viruses. Bleach is also very effective, but so you'd clean up the area of the spill, and then what we're doing is, for any area we're trying to decontaminate in the laboratory, we're wrapping the specimen or whatever we're being used, the outside of the container, in cloth that's saturated with bleach and letting it sit for 10 minutes, which is what the Canadian standard has recommended. Again, this is all planning as to how you're going to manage this ahead of time. All of the material goes into double red bagged and then either has to go out that way or autoclaved in the laboratory before it's disposed of, if that's possible.
And Dr. Cornish, does CDC have recommendations on these kind of accidents?
Yeah, if you see the interim guidance for environmental infection control in hospitals for Ebola virus on our website, it's very clearly outlined there. And it's EPA-approved products that you use, disinfection products.
Very well. So along the same line, how do we deal with contaminated equipment, analyzers we may be doing the testing on, things like that? Dr. Cornish?
For automated test systems, the manufacturer installed safety features and decontamination protocols appropriate for enveloped viruses is what you would use just to ensure a little additional precaution and safety. And then follow the manufacturer's instructions that are generally provided in the operator's manual for cleaning the instrument, and then double check to make sure that what the manufacturer is recommending also will meet the EPA approved and be appropriate for inactivating Ebola virus.
Dr. Peterson, you mentioned signing teams of specific individuals who are specifically designated to manage Ebola, potentially, if there is a patient under investigation. How or should we restrict movement of personnel through testing areas when this is taking place?
Basically, you want to isolate what's being worked on from the rest of the laboratory. It's the general approach of should you have a spill or whatever, you want to contaminate as little of the environment as absolutely possible. So for us, we are working in with the specimens in a biosafety level 2 cabinet and then in one of the isolation rooms. And the technologists will be wearing the full personal protective equipment that is being used, same as for taking care of the patients. There was a Clinical Microbiology Network survey of this, what people are doing in the laboratory last week, and about 90% of laboratories are using the same personal protective equipment as the clinical staff taking care of the patient, and the other 10% are using somewhat less amount of personal protective equipment. And basically what I mean by that, they're not using PAPRs for protecting the head, but they're using face shields and hoods. So this, again, is another decision that needs to be made by the laboratory and considering this. But clearly you want to have the area where the specimens being worked on are in a limited traffic part of the laboratory and have very experienced personnel doing this. We don't let trainees take care of the patients or take care of the specimens. We also limit the number of staff that are doing this primarily because it's so challenging to properly get the personal protective equipment on and then get it off again. The laboratory should use the buddy system just like on the clinical staff, so you really have two people, one person taking care of the specimen, donning the personal protective equipment, and the second person actually helping them with observing the gowning, making sure there's no breaks in techniques, and then also observing the removal of the personal protective equipment so that there's no contamination during the removal process.
Dr. Cornish, if a lab does have a protocol that has testing being done in a non-point-of-care, non-isolation area of the laboratory, how do we address potential aerosol generation during specimen handling and testing?
Well, one of the things to do is to, you know, restrict movement in laboratories where testing of blood and body fluids is performed. That's a work practice control that could be considered to control many potential hazards, but they would have to decide if they were using, for instance, a closed system, how they were going to handle that kind of issue. And since laboratories are set up sometimes on an open design, they're going to need to sit down and figure out how they're going to do that. If they have potentially open systems, they're going to need to work with their industrial hygienist or engineers to decide how they might contain the possible aerosol-generating areas so that it does not contaminate laboratory professionals working in the area. So that's a risk assessment thing that you need to do as well. So you may decide not to use any open systems, and that's certainly a reasonable decision to make. However, that's not something we can mandate from the CDC. What we urge people to do is sit down and make a plan, do a risk assessment and make a plan and develop the procedures and then practice those things. So as Dr. Peterson mentioned, putting on and taking off PPE has to be done a certain way so that you don't contaminate yourself. And practicing is what makes perfect, basically.
Okay. Dr. Peterson touched on this briefly on the issue of potential spills, but in a broader sense, how do we deal with waste disposal? We've done all this testing. We have samples. We may have analyzers or point-of-care type testing equipment. How do we deal with waste disposal for Ebola-infected patients, Dr. Cornish?
So it's classified as a Category A infectious substance by the Department of Transportation. And when it's transported in commerce, it's regulated by Department of Transportation's Hazardous Materials Regulation Act. So any item transported in commerce which is contaminated or suspected of being contaminated with a Category A infectious substance must be packaged and transported in accordance with the DOT. This may include items such as medical equipment, sharps, linens, and used healthcare products, and also used personal protection equipment, or byproducts of cleaning that are contaminated or suspected of being contaminated with Category A substances. So any waste generated during laboratory testing should be placed in a leak-proof container. To minimize contamination of the exterior of the waste bag, you place this bag in a rigid waste container designed for this use. And if available, steam, sterilization, or incineration as a waste treatment process can activate the virus and may reduce waste volume. For equipment that drains directly into plumbing, in your core laboratory, for example, you need to consult with your facility sanitation engineer to identify options for disinfection at the source. So once again, that's part of your risk assessment and then part of your plan and procedures that you would follow. Some equipment and facilities have holding tanks before discharge into the sewer, and you should also check with your state medical waste program for more guidance and coordinate your waste management activities for the laboratory area with your medical waste contractor.
Dr. Peterson, what sort of plans are there at your center for waste disposal?
So basically, as Dr. Corney said, you need to plan for this ahead of time because this generates a lot of waste, and you want to coordinate this with the whole facility waste management for the Ebola patients. This can generate 10 to 20 large bins of waste per day for these patients, and make sure that we've actually gotten letters from our contractors to make sure that they've agreed to take the waste when it's ready to be shipped off site. So these are things that I think, based on experience that we've seen in the U.S., can be challenging, and planning ahead with all the steps on how you're going to manage the waste in each of the departments, as well as how you're going to do a facility-wide management and then transport the waste off site, needs to be planned and agreed to ahead of time by all partners.
Well, thank you again, Dr. Cornish and Dr. Peterson, for taking the time to speak with us today on this timely and important topic. I'm sure our listeners will find this information valuable as they develop their Ebola preparedness plans. And thank you all for joining us.